I'm going to turn the recording device on. For purposes of this exercise, Jim Shields is going to be president, CEO, and chairman of the board. And Ken is going to be the general counsel. Mary Ann's going to introduce our participants.
Oh, okay. So this is Jim Shields, who is a consultant and board member and retired as president of Draper Laboratories, which is a nonprofit from MIT, right? Devoted to developing guidance, navigation, and control technology for space exploration, defense systems, and now they're in biotech, if I'm remembering correctly. During Jim's years at Draper, he increased revenue by nearly 60% and expanded the organization's strategic scope to include biomedical and energy systems. He built new government industry partnerships and led or contributed to studies on topics ranging from electronic warfare to integrating sensor-collected intelligence. Jim earned 2 degrees from MIT in electrical engineering and began his career at GASC. Ken Itrato is an attorney and a principal at the Farber Law Group in Waltham, Massachusetts. Prior to starting his firm and joining Faber, Ken was with WilmerHale. And his area of expertise is in startups, transactional financing and strategic business issues, and many of the companies he works with are startups in the biotech and other technology areas. He handles a range of funding transactions, including venture capital, private equity, angel financing, and debt. He has a strong mergers and acquisitions practice, and he advises clients with respect to the legal implications of their day-to-day operations, from complex customer and supplier relationships to employment and equity compensation. He also counsels clients on mission-critical licensing and partnering transactions involving core assets, technologies, and products. He received his JD from Georgetown University Law School, and he earned the Order of Quoth there, and his bachelor's is from Cornell University, and he attended Phillips Exeter Academy here in Massachusetts. Thank you.
Gentlemen. Okay. Well, folks, this is obviously a pretty serious event and potential significant implications for the future of our company. I look forward to your advice and counsel. However, before we open the floor to questions, suggestions, and discussions, let me tell you what we've done and are planning to do. Of course, during this entire situation, Ken Itrato, our GC, and his staff have been invaluable partners, and Ken is here with me to address any legal questions you might have. Immediately after getting the threat, as you saw, our internal staff has been unable to validate that we've actually been penetrated, and there are some rumors in the industry that some of these things are baseless shakedowns, but we went out and retained Mandiant Computer Emergency Response Team Services. Mandiant is one of the leading independent information security firms in the country to confirm the intrusion and determine the extent of the damage. Unfortunately, at the moment, their work is in progress, so I can't tell you for sure whether they think we're clean or whether we've been penetrated. My recommendation relative to this is that we not pay the ransom. I think it will only leave us open to further extortion, and it doesn't relieve us of any reporting requirements and the associated publicity if the penetration is real. Further, our patients are open to having their data used for identity theft, even if we pay the ransom, and we have a moral obligation to them to tell them about the risk and to do what we can to help them mitigate it. So what we've done in preparation for the meeting today, we've retained a PR firm to help us develop a comprehensive communications plan that includes our patients, all other public announcements that are likely to be required under the HIPAA and SEC rules. Relative to our patients, this communication will tell them about the penetration and the related risk to their personal data, offer them identity theft protection, services to be paid for by us. Equally importantly, this communication will tell them that they might be contacted by the hackers, telling them about their status in the trial, namely whether they're in the control group or the group receiving treatment. We're going to ask them to ignore this information since it may not be correct, and we can't confirm their status without compromising the integrity close to completion of the trial, and we're hopeful the results will be favorable, so we're gonna ask them to hang in with us so that if the trial is successful and the drug is approved, we can get it to market as quickly as possible. And still, we've gotta balance the possibility, we're clearly gonna have to inform the FDA about this, and they may have different views about communications than we do, and we'll tell you about how our plan relative to that is. We're also currently comparing the current trial database to our last backup to see if the trial database has been corrupted by the hackers. Fortunately, we store our backups both off-site and offline, so we think that they're relatively secure. However, one of the things we're gonna ask Mandy to do is to make sure that they haven't been penetrated as well. If we find a penetration, our plan would be to compromise the data. Our plan would be then to go back to the last known good configuration and reapply any missed transactions. So that's kind of what our plan with that would be. After we know our integrity of the database and have a communications plan in place, then we think it's time to go to the FDA trial supervisors. It should only take us about a week to get ready for that, so it leaves us within the 2-week threat window and doesn't leave us looking like we're taking a lot of time before we get to the FDA to tell them about the situation and our response and argue that we think the trial can still be valid and that we should be allowed to proceed to completion with it. We'll also seek advice from outside counsel and independent accountants about our reporting requirements under HIPAA, SEC, and other relevant laws and regulations. So there's a lot going on here, and it's gonna be a pretty hectic period. But that's kind of our view relative to, at this stage, what we think we should do relative to it. But I really wanna draw on your all advice and counsel relative to this plan and any modifications or suggestions you have relative to what we should do. So this time I'll open it to the floor for discussion and comment.
Where is the database kept? I mean, when the clinical trial information comes in, typically is either done in-house,
right,
or you go to a CRO, contract research organization,
yeah, this,
data management.
Yeah, we've kept it all in-house. So we have not used a third party for that, nor have we put anything in the cloud, although it just kind of an offline, we'll talk about that after.
How did you know that there's 90% effectiveness? That says to me that there was an interim analysis or some kind of analysis of the data has been done, giving you a signal of positivity yet not good enough to say stop the trial and treat or accept the drug. So how do you know?
Rephrase the question.
It says here while XYZ's treatment is showing greater than 90% effectiveness, the results are not sufficient for the FDA. That tells me there's been an analysis of the data that you show 90% effectiveness. How did that happen? Who did it? When did that occur? Was it built into the trial? It was a pre-planned analysis. It's very important because somebody has seen the data, and that may be the leak. Somebody knows what's going on here, and I'm not sure if it's all internal, there's an internal person, or was it outsourced? I don't know.
Yeah. We've done it all in-house just for us. Mm-hmm. So it raises a good question. You know, we have not, we do the normal sorts of things relative to employee vetting.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seriously at this stage gone in and tried to find out whether the compromise, if there is one, is internal or not. It's a good question, and we do need to think about that.
That's a problem. That's why.
Factual questions. How many patients are in the trial, and when do you expect to get the report from
Mandy? We expect to hear from Mandy within a couple of days. There are 2,000. The HIPAA reporting requirements are greater than 500, so it's above that level, so we are going to be impacted by HIPAA.
I suppose, though, we may not know, or Mandy may not know conclusively, there's a possibility that what what they get back is inconclusive, so I guess we ought to be thinking about that as a possibility as well.
Jim, has law enforcement, FBI, or other federal agency been notified and involved, and if not, why not? There's no mention of the FBI getting involved or asking them to get involved and potentially helping with this.
At this stage, we've kept it in-house to try to keep, until we understand the situation as best as we can, we figure that it's better to keep it in-house.
We're not sure we've been hacked. So a part of this exercise is, I think we're trying to figure that out, although we're certainly interested in the board's view as to when you think the appropriate time is.
Well, and the reason I asked is they've spent they put a lot of time and effort into cyber detection efforts. This isn't, you know, their mandate changed a bunch of years ago after 9/11. It went from prosecuting and, you know, pursuing perpetrators to, they've got a really big effort around detection as an additional point for potentially validating, as well as, you know, who else has been contacted by this group. They may actually have the information that would accelerate this particular effort to find out and legitimize it. That's what I'm thinking about.
That could be helpful. Is your experience, or do you think that there's risk that that information could leak to the market before the board wants it leaked to the market?
Highly unlikely, in my experience. And I know some folks, I've dealt with some of them around this, and they're working really hard to do this for corporations, as opposed to, you get a call and now, you know, it's on the front page news, or there's somebody who goes to a federal hearing they work very hard to build a trusting relationship with companies to help with these kinds of problems. Because eventually, you know, when they get it, they want to get ahead of it, as opposed to, we've had this problem, we paid them. Okay, at that point, it's really hard for them to do anything.
One of the things Mandy had told us when we retained them is that they're pretty well connected with law enforcement and have their fingers on the pulse for all of that. But that's a good suggestion, and we will. We'll both ask them about that, and we'll also.
I would recommend against it, at least not as a first move.
Right.
Let's remember, the FBI's primary interest is to build an indictable case, and a triable case.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't necessarily to recover your data. They would be happy to do that. They would be happy to identify where it is and get it back and defeat this whole effort. But that isn't their primary interest.
Mm-hmm.
We're watching that unfold, for example, with Mueller right now. And that's the difference, for example, between an intelligence organization whose interest is in getting information versus making a case.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I don't think our primary interest is in making a case. Our primary interest is exploring what's what. It doesn't preclude us from reporting it to the FBI. There are rules, of course, that the FBI operates under about what they have to do if informed of these kinds of things. For example, should they suspect that there's terrorist involvement, then it's basically out of your hands. So I would recommend certainly bringing them in at some point, but not until we understand the terrain a lot better than we do now. For example, as a matter of reality testing, both bodies of data were encrypted, correct? You used the word anonymized. Were they encrypted?
No.
Neither one. Both are in the clear.
Right.
Is that right? They're in clear English. Have you examined, I take it that one list is of the patients, the other list is of patient one, patient two, patient three, and so on. That's the extent of the concealment. Is it actually possible for them to do what they say they can do, and that is link the one with the other?
Well, obviously.
Can I add to that as well, because that was going to be my question, is that are both sets of data on the same server or on different servers? So how many servers, because you're not hosted on the cloud, therefore you must have internal servers. How many servers do you have? And data on the same server or on different servers?
Well, but let me, I don't think it's necessary to know that, to know in whatever servers they're located, can they can this be done? Is their threat plausible from that respect?
We believe that it can be done.
You believe that it can be done?
Right.
But are you sure it can be done?
Well, yeah, our people can do it.
Okay.
But there's, you know, there's, yeah, so okay. Depending on how much information
so
they have.
Sufficiently competent people looking at these two lists, it is not adequately anonymized to prevent
right.
them from doing
right.
what you say.
Right.
All
right.
Okay.
I had the same question about the servers, because if you're going to communicate to the patients that not to listen to the hackers, their information may not be correctly, I'd like to know if it's possible for the hackers to get into the patient database but not the clinical trial database. And if we can honestly tell patients that don't listen to them, it may not be true.
They're on two different servers, but we are not confident that they couldn't have hit both of them.
You don't know. Though.
We don't know.
This investigation by
right.
your information
right.
security organization
right.
is going to bring a lot to this discussion.
Exactly.
And you say that's 2 days off.
A couple days off.
All right. So really, I mean, to define this question, what we really are talking about is what ought we to do pending discovering a whole lot more 2 days from now, if anything.
I mean, I'm still just not clear that this is real or not, and I'm not sure if this being blackmailed from within. I mean, there's a lot of signals here in the case that say, it sounds soft, but what is the morale in your company right now? You're on the brink of something huge, not just for the Parkinson's, but for this company, but there's Alzheimer's
yeah.
coming, there's these other things. So are people happy about it? But sometimes the devil is within, and it could be this disgruntled employee who had access to the database. I mean, you know, there's the medical phrase, it looks like a horse and smells like a horse, it's a horse. It's not a zebra. And we don't need to go looking for the Martian or, you know, the terrorist in the organization. So there's just a lot of things I think internally we can still do before we, and I probably don't appropriately call the FBI or look at it. We don't understand the situation, or at least I don't.
I just want to add to that. Do we know who has access to both those databases within the company as well? So the same people, are there people in the company that have access to both data, or is there clear delineation of roles and therefore it'd be easy to see a crossover?
There are defined roles and responsibilities, so we know, we can figure out who's got access to both. And it,
and is that a small group of individuals, or is that a large group of individuals?
I do believe that early on, and when exactly it happens, right away or shortly, that the patients involved in the trial should get a broader description of what's going on. So not telling them that you will be contacted and it's not true information, because you don't know that it is true or false, but at least letting them know that there are some concerning things that have come to your attention, and you're still trying to figure out whether or not these are true or false. They could involve your personal record, and so if you are contacted with anything, we, you know, we are advising you at this point to not pay attention to it until we can figure out what's going on. And to let us know that you've been contacted, that's important as well. I mean, I don't think you have to sort of say, you know, it's specifically this is what it is, and what they're telling you is false, because that's not something that you can at least say with some certainty.
I'm going to arbitrarily stop this in about 5 minutes, because we have 20 minutes more left to go, and I want to make sure that the moderators can sort of process what you've all been saying, and then we can talk at beyond the case and better. So 5 more minutes and then we'll stop.
Have there been any cases similar to this in any other companies that you can look to see if there's a precedent, if whether it was successful, how it was handled?
There's nothing publicly available. There are some rumors that there have been, threats like this, but we don't have any direct knowledge of a company and how they've dealt with it or how it's ended up. So we don't have that level of data available to us right now.
So, but what we do know then is that any company who might have had this sort of threat never publicly had to go, never had to go public. So there is probably some value in that.
If in fact this has happened,
if in fact,
generally what happens, companies handle this themselves, but there's no way to know. I think, to me, to try and define, you know, to define this problem, I'll be a contrarian, I think what we need to focus on is the next 2 days and what happens after the next 2 days. In the next 2 days, there's very little we can do that you have not already done. You have put people online that you will need to have online. There's nothing that you can do per se to investigate. You've hired another company to investigate. You're not competent to investigate yourselves. I think it's extremely important that they get in on time so that the period of exposure, at least ignorant exposure, where you really don't know what's going on, is only 2 days. For that reason, I disagree with my friend. I don't believe patients should be informed. We're only looking at 2 days here. If I were a ransomware blackmailer, the last thing I would want to do is give away any bit of value of the information that I'm holding. To call up patients and allude to the fact that they may have a problem is to take something out of my hand. It adds to my credibility, but it gives up something too. I don't think they will do that. And by your alerting them, your patients, I think if you are stuck with a double blind, you will have blown the double blind at that point by telling them that there is this issue. One other thing to add, there are rules, I don't know them the way I think you do, there are rules whereby after a trial has gone sufficiently far and you get a positive result to the tune of 90%, which is uncommonly good, right? I mean, normally we're talking about 60%, 65%,
it would be
or
approved.
Even 55%.
If that's true, they'd stop the trial.
They would stop the trial and they would let you go, in which case what these guys have, it's still valuable in terms of their ability to blackmail patients and so on, but as it bears on the enterprise, the whole situation changes.
One more comment that will stop.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
You had me at the don't call the feds, but then you lost me on the like two or three key elements here. That gaming the case and its dynamics, there's additional depth and complexity that can be added to this dynamic, and you pointed out some inconsistencies in the way the case is put together. But part of what I see in this, and my reaction is we haven't really practiced, we haven't really talked about cybersecurity and consequences, and we haven't really, scrimmaged incidents and scenarios like this, which, with all due respect, sorry to be so disagreeable, thought you've been hacked. And for you as the counselor to the company to say you haven't been hacked is disingenuous. So there's a, we don't know yet, which is a kind of a case issue, but it's also a mindset of the advisory role. So if you've been hacked and we can wait, or you've been hacked, now what? And that's what needs to be SOP, not some exceptional call a special board meeting. So I don't hear confidence in your team and its preparedness for this event, and I think that's worth a board conversation about how to cover that gap. The second kind of non-technical thing I would point to, and by the way, it's a great case. I mean, that's why I'm here, and apologies for being late, because I just love the topic and the potential to reconnect. But the most important thing is we don't have a real good handle on the human element of the patient and the experience that they're going through. This debate is a fair debate, but that's the conversation. Like, I don't know if you're right or he's right, but what are the values of the company? What do we say to the patients? How do we, dare I say it, seize this as an opportunity as we accelerate to be a different sort of patient engagement company? That element of the opportunity here can't be squeezed out of the board conversation. Because if it is, you've lost. A million isn't gonna make a difference to your balance sheet. What's gonna make a difference to your company is how you respond and create a habit of response to these events. Because if you're that good, you're gonna be a target. And no, you've been hacked. Now what? So that element is important and not the human, how good's the team, how are we gonna communicate with patients? You're all scientists and it comes through in this. If there's technical issues that could have been done better, yeah, but the people part, missing.
Why don't we stop at this point and you guys can drop.
That's it.
Okay.
I'll narrow my question.
Yeah.
Moving on. Is there an insurance policy in place for the $100 million of loss of sales? Could you come up with a number that would say this would be the worst case scenario and it's some portion of that $100 million of lost sales and gross profit or profit therein?
We don't have, we've got general business insurance. We don't have specific cyber insurance. And so we're talking, you know, we have to investigate what sort of insurance coverage we've got. We don't have any answer.
Let's stop the role play at this point. And gentlemen, would you want to comment on what you heard and what, and get to give us some of your thoughts?
The case was set up with a view to raise awareness of people relevant to these particular issues. And Ben, I would agree with you, and you know, when I was running a company, my interaction with the board was not an issue of will we be hacked, but when will we be hacked. And you know, you need to be in a position to believe that you have done everything you can practically do to protect yourself in advance of event, and still then be prepared for it, because it's, you know, this is an area that is incredibly offense advantaged. You know, the attackers only have to be right once; you've got to be right all the time. And so it's, you know, anybody who thinks they're safe is naive. And so from that point of view, there are situations that this firm, hypothetical firm, hasn't done. Encrypting data at rest is clearly something one should be doing in a situation like this.
Yeah.
Being prepared with a prior board discussion about what do we do when things happen in this sort of environment is the kind of thing that a company should have done. Regular external penetration testing, so that you've got a relationship with somebody like Mandiant, independent of your own resources in advance of that. If you get to the stage, and CurePak made things simple by making sure that we kept everything in-house, but in, you know, the situation, if you're using third-party sources for any of this, making sure that your terms of service level agreements with them deal with that. Even if you're putting things in the cloud, which the trend is moving, you got to worry about those sorts of things. So that there's a number of issues you have to pay attention to when contracting with third parties. That, for simplicity, I tried to leave out of this case, but things that you need to worry about.
The insurance piece is also, it's interesting in that folks feel if I buy a policy, I'm great. If you're not up to snuff with all the best practices, you can file a claim, but you won't get paid.
Yeah.
Make it simple. Because there's a whole series of rules, and a lot of them now, the companies that are writing the policies are forcing companies to work with advisors who are specialists on cyber to, here's your game plan to cover, whether it's a NIST framework or whatever framework you want to choose, FFIEC, depends upon your industry, that forces you to have a game plan to make yourself not only be as protected as you can, but what's my response, my recovery plan, all those things. Otherwise, you get nothing from it. Because this is like, you know, I have insurance in my house, but I live in a high crime neighborhood and I don't lock my doors. As a matter of fact, I leave my doors open and I invite everybody to come in. It's essentially that simple. It's a pretty interesting space. Because the onus is really on the insurer to be up to snuff, otherwise you just don't
hang price tags on each of your items.
Mike?
It occurs, I was thinking about some of the issues that I was just touching on, and it occurred to me that if I were in the firm before the event had occurred, just having a general awareness of the potential, the risk. Approaching one or two insurance companies for a $100 million cyber intrusion policy might be a very valuable exercise for the firm, because in the role play, you touched upon all sorts of some subtle, some pretty blatant mistakes that were made in the architecture of the system and the operation of the system. And by having an insurance company who is in the business of doing this underwrite a $100 million policy for you, I know, being a naive homeowner, I learn a great deal when I get quotes you know, for various kinds of risk from the insurance company that's going to underwrite me. So just to throw that out.
Mm-hmm. This may sound like an ad for the firm, but there should be a crisis plan. There should be some plan in place for situations like this, where you have the right people involved, where you know who you're going to go to, and the steps that you're going to take. Because particularly when you're public and you deal with HIPAA and everything else, there are so many regulatory components to this that the flags are all up in terms of how much time do you have, and your comment about speaking with patients, well then are you violating sort of the SEC rules in terms of a level playing field, sort of telling somebody something that other, that investors might know. So I say you hire David, and then you can talk.
I agree.
I was just wondering, where are you going to buy the bitcoins?
You're going to sell the bitcoins.
Out of a reserve. Meaning, yeah. Should the company actually have a bitcoin reserve?
Just to understand, have we left the problem, and now are we speaking about how to have kept that problem from ever arising? Or are we still talking about the problem, because taking out insurance and having a crisis plan at all is swell. But we got a problem right now.
Right.
And the fact that we haven't done these things is a big mistake. But we got to live with that mistake. Are we still talking about the problem?
Yeah, about 5 minutes ago, Larry called it in. An end to the role play.
Okay, so we're not talking about the problem.
We're past the simulation.
I think everything that everyone has said is, of course, absolutely true.
As a board exercise, and what I thought was the most interesting thing about the case, is it does force us to think about everybody that as board members we would owe duties to. And we didn't have time to sort of get all of them, but I think it's sort of useful, you know, when a board member to start thinking about, what are the categories of folks that I owe something to? And those are, you know, your patients, you know, your employees, your people, sort of how are you going to deal with that? As a board member, you've got a fiduciary duty to your stockholders. You need to think about how those disclosures are going to work. You know, certainly the regulators have got an interest in how you're handling this, both securities regulators, but also you know, those, you know, dealing with the clinical trial. And so, as an exercise, you know, I always sort of try to take a look at these issues and sort of see who are the groups of people that are going to be sort of hurt or upset, and then how do we craft an answer that is going to be most beneficial to them and least injurious to us.
Well, and there's a third category, which is people to whom we owe a legal obligation, who may not be hurt and not upset, but may be willing to put you in jail.
Are we as board members trying to educate ourselves and figure this out all on our own? Because this is a broader question. I was telling Jim that I conducted a cybersecurity study. So you're talking to CISOs and CIOs last year, talking to between 50 and 100. It becomes a really interesting issue for board members relative to education. Now, if I'm on the board of a, I don't know, $500 million or $2 billion community bank, I might be a local business person. If I'm on the board of a $2 billion healthcare company, a pharma company, maybe it's a little different. But the fundamental question to me is, how do we get educated? And what's the role of the company to help me figure that out, or am I on my own? Because, you know, to the gentleman's point and your point, are we figuring this all out in real time, each of us by ourselves, and if we're the operating board, how do we do this and then do something in a common direction so that, you know, we're mitigating, we're dealing with this, but we're also not allowing this to happen next week and the week after. So that to me is a big issue for us.
Can I take a crack at answering my question?
Please.
In theory, we're all supposed to be together. In practice, we're not. You know, we've all been in boards, we all know CEOs who want to keep their boards as uninformed as humanly possible, so that the font of wisdom is the CEO, and the CEO will come and say, I've done A, B, C, and D, and nobody on the board can say, have you thought D and E? It's the role of the Nominating Governance Committee to ensure that the right people are on the board. It's the role of the Nominating Governance Committee to ensure that the board members are educated for their roles. It is not the CEO's role to do that. It's the Nominating Governance role made up of board members to ensure the fellow board members are. In practice, I find most Nominating Governance Committee members are not doing their job. They're expecting the CEO to tell them what to do, which is wrong. It should be the Nominating Governance Committee, not the CEO, who makes those decisions. So that's one issue.
And the Nominating Governance Committee should work with the board to make sure they're taking on their role of risk management, because it is looking at all the different kinds of risks that a company can occur.
Also, in honor of Jim's defense background, there's a wonderful story that they tell about the Naval War College. And that is, in Britain, before World War II, they were studying war issues sort of like textbook and lecture discussion. And so for them, the Japanese were just not very good warriors. And besides, you can't sink a carrier, an aircraft tank. You can't sink those things, they're unsinkable. U.S. Navy War College in Providence, on the other hand, did lots of scenario planning, cases like these. And then they realized you don't need to sink an aircraft carrier, you can just bomb the runway, so it's kind of useless. So having thought that thing through, because they did the scenarios, they came up with an answer for what do we do if the runway is bombed, and they were able to continue on despite that, which is an example why these kinds of scenario situations that we've done this afternoon, even if we don't get a conclusion, it's the beginning to think the process through, so that if Jim is right, and I think Jim is right, when it happens, when you are attacked, you'll have gone through the process several times before.
So when do boards do that? Like, is it part of the board meeting, or is it a separate exercise to?
Should be part of the board meeting, but again, the driver should be the Nominating Governance Committee. It will never be the CEO. CEO wants the agenda packed with the issues the CEO wants.
Larry, at the cost of using valuable time of board members and so on, and I know it is, but in consistent with the idea of coming up with a crisis plan, because you can't do all the reference work with respect to FDA regs and what the FBI requires and doesn't require of you in real time. That really is crazy. So this is actually a perfect vehicle for a war game. In fact, more than one war game. It may, and one of them has to involve real live board members. There are a variety of ways of doing this. You can hold them at lower levels and actually then go through, you know, the ultimate one using the findings from the lower level to see what the board thinks about that. But the process of going through that, involving scenarios, is a perfect process for developing that crisis plan that you were talking about. You do it experientially.
Yeah, and I think the plan itself, like you're saying, has to happen. I mean, this needs to be solved, this situation, but there'll be more, because you either give the money, or one option was to give the money to the Black Hills. or this can happen again because this company is sitting on, seems like a gold mine of pipeline interest. So, all right, CERT, I think that's Cyber Attack Emergency Response Team. Someone had the wherewithal to pull in CERT, which was great. I'd like to ask that person on the side, why didn't you do that earlier? Like, well, if you knew it was CERT, why did it come only when the house was on fire? You know, why didn't you know it? But now that it's here, that group needs to, like I say, almost be one of your key vendors. They need to always be there if you're going to stay in the business, right? Because again, there are all these hints that you kind of threw in here of like data and analysis. And so who has access? And in terms of the patients and everything, you're right. You know, I mean, I'm living that sort of, now not in crisis management, but when do you inform patients? There's also the concept in this particular case of once you let out the information that we've been hacked, we've been, your data's been compromised, and your trust goes out the window. So not only have your patients now said your trust out the window, your investigators, your trust has been out the window, your future pipeline is diminished because now your investigators are not saying, well, isn't that the company that we lost all the data, and I don't know what the real, and then the trust in the stock goes down, and you see the cascade, it's a negative domino type of effect. So you, in my opinion, you really have to be careful before you go out there to say this is what's happening, because the more you put out there, people are going to ask you questions, and like we were asking you questions, and it's a case. But if you don't know the answer, and a lot of the answers weren't known, it's doubly damned.
I agree. Although, as you point out, and yeah, a lot of companies I just got, there's an organization that I'm a part of, and they sent me a somewhat vague letter that they believe that they have been compromised, and they had taken certain steps to mitigate any, you know, fallout from it, even as they investigated it. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, in the early days of people getting hacked, it was a little scarier. I mean, it's still a scary scenario when it happens, but it was so strange. What does that mean? You know, they're gonna come and suck all the money out of a bank or whatever it may be. Nowadays, everyone's getting hacked at some level, whether it's your Twitter account, whether it's Facebook, whether it's a company's finance, you know, pool or whatever it might be. And so I don't know, yes, it will be detrimental, there will be some negative impact, but I think people realize it's the nature of the game nowadays. There's always someone trying to hack. So it's just how you manage the information that you put out, you know, how much you tell.
Isn't it relative, though?
You know,
yeah.
Isn't the value of the data relative to the response that you give and when you give it? Because the value of this data is relative to, you know, a huge portion of people for a lifetime period, you know, in terms of the clinical research. You know, bank data, yes, none of us want our banking information given out, but I think the response and, the, and when it's given out is relative to the value of the data that other people have.
I was going to say that you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you, except that in this healthcare industry, the cascade of events and how it's affected and the negative halo, you don't recover. And the company can actually fall because of this. Because
let's take one more comment and then we'll have to close up.
I think from a, as we're talking about board responsibility and governance, this is, we're talking about hacking, but I think it's important for boards to understand what the key risks are overall. We do obviously a lot of crisis planning, and hacking is always one that people want to be prepared for, but I think the broader point is boards need to be prepared for whatever that company's key risks are.
Yeah.
Understand all of those, regardless of what industry it may be. In this company, it may be preparing for, maybe it's not 90%, maybe it was 10% of what happens if our drug fails, or it doesn't sell.
Or if it's tainted.
Or if it's tainted or something.
Manufacturing.
I think as we talked about governance, it occurred to me that we're talking about hacking, and we need to be prepared for that event, but there are so many events companies can have just for boards to understand.
I'd like to give a nice round to Jim and Ken for putting together this thing. I think the lesson I'm taking away from this entire discussion is if you're on a board or if you're a CEO, you walk in assuming that you will be attacked. You walk in putting together the plan on that based on that assumption. Line up your ducks ahead of time. It just is. That's the way it is. Next month we will have a very different kind of case. There are far more family businesses here in the Boston area than there are public companies like this pharmaceutical company. And we're going to be, you are going to be on the board, an independent director of a family business that, guess what, has some family tensions.
Not bad.
What's the date, Larry?
It's going to be the last Thursday of the month, whatever that is.
September, yeah.
We always meet the last Thursday of the month, except November, which is the second Thursday. So thank you very much. Please feel free to continue to stay and schmooze. You're a good group, you're an intelligent group. Get to know each other. Thank you very much.
Very good.